Today in Studio 360... What's that, Miss Othmar? Yeah, I know there's a book about Charles Schulz. He was what? Depressed? Had marital problems and an existential crisis?
You blockhead!
He saw himself as a lonely and frustrated young man who wanted one thing, which was to become a cartoonist.
Biographer David Michaelis will take us inside the mind of Charles Schulz, the creator of Peanuts. Plus, for 30 years now, Carl Hiaasen has been writing crime novels about the freaks and losers and scumballs of South Florida. Just don't call him a grouch.
A lot of the funniest writers I know have a deep vein of anger, and it's a sense of sort of ironic outrage at things, and they're writing for a reason.
That and much more is ahead today in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. But to start things off, 20 years ago, a promising young artist started showing her paintings and photographs at galleries in Soho. Since then, Yu Ling has built a respectable career with exhibits in Los Angeles, Miami, Munich, London, as well as New York. Then a few years ago, the art world learned the truth about Yu Ling. She's Lucy Liu. Yep, that Lucy Liu, the co-star of Ally McBeal, Charlie's Angels, Kill Bill, and currently the TV series Elementary, in which she plays Watson to a modern-day Sherlock Holmes. So, Yu Ling, Lucy Liu, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you so much for having us.
Exactly. I had no idea you were a visual artist. Did you have, as a young person, an aha moment where you decided you needed to do this?
I think as a young person, creativity was not something that we were encouraged to sort of think about, work on, just sort of even live in.
Really?
In that space. It was very much about survival, you know, just getting by.
So when did you discover that I want to make art, I want to act, all those things?
I discovered it when I was very young, but it seemed like it was something that was just very trivial in terms of pursuing it as a career. And then once I left NYU, I was there for a year, I transferred to the University of Michigan, I sort of just started taking classes that I wanted to take. And it was my first foray outside of the city, and it was also my first time away from my family. And I just chose all the different classes that I wanted to take. I took art history, I took Chinese, I took ceramics, I took, you know, anything that I thought was interesting. And then I sort of discovered that nobody was stopping me or, you know, grabbing me by the shoulder and
saying,
"Not
even your parents?"
No, I mean, they weren't really aware of the classes I was taking. They never asked. I was the third born, and my sister had gone to Cornell, my brother at Columbia. So I think they were sort of at that point just, I was out loose.
I know how that youngest child thing goes. You get away with murder.
You get away with things, and nobody's checking. I mean, if you're still alive, you know, and you have a heartbeat, then everything's okay.
Exactly. So you get out of college. Do you think, I'm going to be an actor, I'm going to be a painter, I'm going to be both? What was the idea?
When I got out of college, I knew that I was going to be an actor. I had a very pivotal moment at the end of the year where I did a play and I was cast as the lead. And that was the first time I recognized that as somebody who was Asian, I could do something that was not behind the scenes. And I always felt that it was something that I couldn't achieve. You know, there was nobody in entertainment on the forefront of it that had an Asian face.
Well, there barely is now.
They're still working on it.
That's charitable.
Coming together slowly. But that was the first time I recognized there was a possibility, and I just grabbed it.
What made you decide you would do one under this pseudonym and one under your name?
When I came out with a show and I went to Munich and I did a show there, I decided to use my Chinese name because I did not want people to judge the work or come just because it was me. I wanted it to be more of an open...
It was after you had gotten success as
yes,
an actor.
Yes, exactly. I think that when I decided to put a book together just 2 years ago was when the person said, well, we should probably use your real name. And I thought about it for a while and I realized that, you know what, people are going to criticize whether or not you use your name or not, or they're going to come or they're going to see it or not. I decided just to sort of embrace it fully and just go for it.
In 2004, you're a movie star. You've just been in Kill Bill. You move back to New York and enroll at the New York Studio School. What were you thinking? Why did you need to do that?
Yes, and I'll give you the reasoning behind that. As I went to a couple of different galleries, and they said, "Well, what's your background? Where's your degree?" And apparently, it seemed like nobody really wanted to get involved if you didn't have a master's.
Really, you couldn't just say, "Hey, I'm Lucy Liu."
No, that's not going to buy you anything but pain and trouble. So that's when I started thinking that maybe this is something that I need to do in order to, you know, be considered a real artist.
Well, that's wrong, but okay, I get it.
It was wrong because I think in the end, it's not about having a degree. It's about your work and what that presentation is. And while I was in school, I really learned that, you know, I don't really need to pursue a master's. I love being in classes. I love painting. I love doing sculpture. And if people like it or they want to be a part of it, then great.
And do you paint while you're work? I mean, doing a show, 22 episodes a year, that's a lot of work. Do you do between that? I mean, how do those two parts of your life fit in together?
It's basically a flow. I will, if I have smaller works, I'll bring them with me. If I have larger pieces, I'll just go back to the studio and work on it. But I always have something on hand, generally. I never am empty-handed. And, you know, much to the dismay of a lot of people, I always show up to work with, you know, 3 or 4, maybe 7 bags of stuff. And I bring it to the trailer and, you know, because I just never know if I'm going to have time or if inspiration is going to strike.
So in this show, Elementary, you're starring as Watson, Joan Watson, opposite Johnny Lee Miller as Sherlock Holmes. I read that you turned down this role again and again when it was offered at first.
I turned it down the first time because I was concerned about the fact that it was another incarnation of Holmes and Watson. And I felt that it would be, again, something that would be under the microscope of the critics and other people that were huge fans. And I also thought that it could work without the names. You could just substitute anybody's name. It could be Johnson and Smith, you know, why not? But Rob Doherty, who I work with, and I just think he's wonderful.
Who created the show.
Yeah, he's the creator of the show, was very firm and very clear and very confident about the use of that and the history of that and the literature that, you know, he wanted to sort of embed in there, but at the same time modernize it.
Holmes in the show is a recovering heroin addict, and it's set in present-day New York. You start out as his sort of recovery buddy, coach, and then become his detective partner. I want to play a clip. This is a scene where the two of you are sitting at a cafe on a stakeout.
Do you think we're cut off from the world? You know, neither of us dates, neither of us really goes out much at all, actually.
We're not cut off from the world. We're engaged in creating one that's actually worth living in.
Well, my friend signed me up for this dating website, and I think I'm going to put my profile up. You know, so be nice if I bring anyone around, okay?
Won't be an issue.
Why won't it be an issue?
Because you won't actually bring anyone around. I've lived most of my life with the firm conviction that romantic love is a delusion. It's a futile hedge against the existential terror that is our own singularity. Then I met someone who calls herself Irene Adler, and that forced me to re-examine those convictions. She, of course, turned out to be a criminal.
Never really discussed how that made you feel.
I feel liberated.
That was Lucy Liu and Johnny Lee Miller in Elementary. It's interesting that you are very much playing the Watson role, even in character moments like that. Did you... once you decided to do it, did you go back and read Arthur Conan Doyle?
Absolutely. Actually, it was the first time I had read any of the literature at all. It was not something that we grew up reading,
right,
or having been, you know, we didn't even have bedtime stories. So when people bring up stories now,
jeez,
I'm sort of shocked. I mean, it wasn't that kind of a life. It was, you know, I mean, my sister, we spoke Chinese at home, so it would be very unlikely for us to learn English
right,
until she went to kindergarten,
yeah,
essentially.
Is there some kind of role? I mean, you've done a range of roles, played bad people, good people, in between people. Is there something you've always wanted to do that would be against type? That why can't I get cast as that?
For a while, I was really getting a lot of offers and cast as sort of the baddie, you know.
Off of the Ally McBeal character?
It was sort of the stunts and the action and that kind of...
Oh, and
of,
the Kill Bill,
yeah,
I suppose,
like
helped
the cutting
as well?
The heads and things like
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
You know, those small things.
Yeah.
And people really wanted that. It sort of got their blood going.
The price you pay for bringing up either my Chinese or American heritage as a negative is I collect your head.
And it's funny because I didn't really enlist myself in that field when I started. And I had to learn those things and really engage myself in a physical manner that I did not know that I was going to have to do.
Yeah.
And so the one thing that I can say that is a bit of a struggle is not being able to portray characters that were in history already, you know, because there's a lot of emphasis.
Because history has left out Asian people?
They say that the Asian generation is the invisible generation, basically, that, you know, because you're not black and because you're not white, then people don't think that you have prejudice. And I don't completely agree with that.
Yeah.
And, you know, I don't find that it's always the case that people of Asian descent are going to, you know, protest and make a big stink out of something. You know,
right.
In our culture, there is something that's about acceptance and about, you know, saving face. And so it's a very different dynamic that we have in terms of the struggle that we try to express ourselves.
And there is also, as long as we're trucking in stereotypes here, something about, no, don't go into acting, become a doctor, become an engineer. I mean, is that part of it as well?
Absolutely. I mean, I had that for sure. And it's not even about don't go into acting. It was sort of like, what is that? There's not even a category for art, you know.
But you're growing up in New York, but that had no impact on how your parents thought of what that might mean.
Absolutely not. Because we grew up in Queens, in Jackson Heights. We went to school. We came back from school. We were latchkey kids. We let ourselves in. We did our homework. We watched TV. They came home. You know, it's just we ate a TV dinner, we went to bed. And TV dinner was not like a bad thing. It was like a luxury.
I love TV dinners.
It was
as a kid.
Luxury yeah. to have a TV dinner.
And once it all worked out, this career that they had no basis for imagining or understanding, were your parents thrilled as parents should be?
I'm not sure thrilled is in the category.
Really?
I think it was just about, she's not going to starve on the street. She's not going to jump from from the Hollywood sign. My father was very upset when I left New York to come to Los Angeles, and I hadn't heard from him for a very long time. And then one day I got in the mail a check for $100, and I just out of nowhere, you know, not really any note attached or anything like that. And then I found out later that he had read in a paper that an actress who wasn't doing well had jumped from the sign, and he was afraid that I was going to be, you know, in that position. But it's a different form of expression of showing concern.
So they're more relieved than ecstatic.
Exactly. Relief is a really – are they relieved? Yes. Absolutely.
Well,
exclamation
congratulations. Lucy Liu, thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure.
Lucy Liu just started the fourth season of her show Elementary. You can see her there Thursday nights on CBS, and you can see some of her paintings at studio360.org. A clean up woman is a woman who gets all the lovely girls behind. Coming up, we'll find out how a depressed loner created America's most beloved comic strip.
He turned to her on their honeymoon as they drove west to Colorado Springs and said, you know, I don't think I'll ever be happy.
The psychodrama behind Peanuts. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. You're listening to Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson. Thanksgiving marks the official start of the holiday season, which means we now have to stop rolling our eyes at the Christmas branding that's been all over retail world since Halloween. Here at Studio 360, the team and I are especially excited this year because we are having a holiday film festival. We want you to make a movie about Christmas or Hanukkah or Kwanzaa or the solstice, really anything wintry and festive. The catch, it's got to be 30 seconds or less. The actor and very funny friend of the show, Jenny Slate, is the judge of our contest. And if you want to try to get in good, here are the holiday tropes to which she is partial.
Great relationships with old people who are lonely and young people welcome them into their lives, anything with animals, especially mice or poodles. I love anything that has an element of like a feast.
Sounds perfect for Thanksgiving week. Plus, you'll have some free time and a lot of people around that you can conscript as actors. The deadline to send us your 30-second long It's a Wonderful Short is December 7th. It's only a week away, so do it. You can find out all the details and see your competition so far at studio360.org/wonderfulshort. One of the big movies this holiday season is already open, and it's one engineered to appeal to the child or the sentimentalist in each of us.
Excuse me. Sorry.
Charlie Brown, you blockhead!
Good grief.
Charlie Brown makes his feature film debut in the Peanuts movie that's in theaters now in 3D, which, of course, is a far cry from the Peanuts of yesteryear. As a kid, I read Peanuts every day in the Omaha World Herald and even bought the paperback anthologies. But the characters and story in the new movie will be familiar. Charlie Brown's best pal is still Snoopy. He's still bullied by Lucy. And he's still trying to win the affections of the little red-haired girl. Turns out that character was based on a real girl who snubbed Charles Schulz when he was young. The writer David Michaelis wrote a biography of the cartoonist. He told me Schulz was a paralyzingly shy, very complicated kid growing up in Minnesota.
He, on the one hand, saw himself as a lonely and alienated and somewhat frustrated young man who wanted one thing, which was to become a cartoonist. The idea of drawing was not the way you put food on the table. And also something that is called tall poppy culture, meaning that when you think too big of yourself and you reach, put your head up too high, it gets lopped off. And his father, a barber, would say frequently to him, don't get a big head. Don't think too well of yourself. And there comes Schulz drawing Charlie Brown, a character with an enormous head. And always Charlie Brown in the early days was realizing he wanted to be president or a general. He had grandiose dreams that were always handed back to him by a father who wouldn't even vote for him.
What's going on here? What are you guys talking about?
I think Charlie Brown would make a great candidate for student body president.
That sounds great, but I don't think I could win.
I'd hate to run and find that nobody wanted me to be president. I don't think I could stand that.
Schulz feared in some ways that he was so bland in appearance, in manner, that if he were seen in downtown St. Paul, even by someone who knew him, they would look right through him. They wouldn't recognize him.
My recollection of Peanuts was that I liked them, and there's a lot of this rueful comedy, sad laughs in it. The ones that actually make me laugh, inevitably, are Lucy being mean.
I would see Charlie Brown fretting over what to do with Lucy. Was he going to kick her off the baseball team? What was he going to do about her? He was sick of her. That was it. And she fires back at him, you know, if you kick me off the team, I'll never speak to you again. But I'll sure yell at you a lot. She sounds a lot like someone who's about to become an ex-wife there. And sure enough, when she was kicked off the team, that was the month that the Schulzes divorced.
So the ex-wife was the muse in all of her difficulty.
The dynamics and emotional realities of their marriage were very much the fuel that the strip was burning every week and was giving it its edge, giving it its reality.
And you have hundreds, 200 of them in the book, which is a great thing for a biography, this biography, to have.
I was very lucky to have the good grace of United Media, which charged me a nickel a strip to reproduce them on the basis that Lucy had charged a nickel for psychiatric help. And the symmetry really is quite startling.
Let's, if we can, look at some of the Peanut strips. I believe Charlie Brown went to camp regularly, did he not? And here he is on the bus going to camp looking out the window and speaking, well, here I am on a bus going to camp. These camp buses are pretty nice, I guess. We've only been on this bus for 10 minutes and already I'm lonesome. I feel like I'm being drafted.
Well, Schulz here is looking back and seeing himself or remembering the feelings he had when he was sent off to war 4 days after his mother died and a day after he buried her. He was 20 years old. She had just died of a terrible cervical cancer. But he was not told that his family labored on with her illness. He could hear her cries of pain but did not know what was going on. This trauma was accentuated by World War II. Off he went. And it was on the troop train as it left St. Paul that he looked out the window and could see the house he grew up in. He could see where he and his mother had gone on the streetcar when he was a child. And he was able, I think, also to use the actual literal words of the memory in a strip just a couple of pages on where Peppermint Patty is boarding a bus for camp and she says to Marcy, "That was very embarrassing, Marcy. Why did you have to tell Chuck that we'd miss him and that we love him?" And Marcy's saying, "It was the tenderness of the moment, sir, knowing that we were going off to camp." And then Marcy looks out the window with a really woebegone look and says, "And we may never see each other again." And then Peppermint Patty says, "Marcy!" Well, Schultz, the night before his mother died, was on his way back to camp, and his mother said to him, "Well, Sparky, I guess it's time to say goodbye." And Schultz said, "Yeah, I've got to go back to Fort Snelling." And she said, "No, it's time for us to say goodbye. We may never see each other again." And that line echoes and echoed through his life, and we see it again and again.
Well, and the fact that it wasn't a happy comic strip was what made it so singular and ultimately beloved by people, yeah?
Well, I remember both in the strip, but less so there, to tell you the truth. I remember it distinctly as an 8 to 10-year-old watching every year in the early days of the Christmas special, a Charlie Brown Christmas. And there would come a moment where Charlie Brown would say, "I'm depressed.
Just don't understand Christmas, I guess. I like getting presents and sending Christmas cards and decorating trees and all that, but I'm still not happy. I always end up feeling depressed."
Charlie Brown, you're the only person I know who can take a wonderful season like Christmas and turn it into a problem.
Maybe Lucy's right. Of all the Charlie Browns in the world, you're the Charlie Browniest.
That seemed to me to symbolize that melancholy one felt but had not yet articulated.
Yeah, the children on Father's Knows Best and Leave It to Beaver were never just depressed.
The boy, and I'm sorry I'm forgetting his name, but the boy who read the part, who spoke the part of Charlie Brown, recalled years later during an anniversary of the Charlie Brown Christmas that he himself felt nearly embarrassed or awkward when he had to speak these lines because he knew how sophisticated they were. He knew that they were the words of adults. There was something scary. There was something taboo about them. It was, I guess, probably for the way my children watch Family Guy these days and get a kind of edgy adult world coming out of a childish show.
And he was also a believing Christian, yeah?
He was. He came back from World War II and, like so many veterans, joined a church. And his church was the Church of God. He was baptized in Lake Fallon in Minnesota in the summer of 48 and became an extremely devoted believer. And yet though he did not like to stand on a street corner and expound beliefs, he nevertheless did some at certain points with his youth group actually become a street corner preacher.
Well, and beyond that, in the first Charlie Brown Christmas, the first big primetime special, he puts biblical text into this show, which caused a bit of a ruckus.
Well, and we all remember the moment of Linus stepping out. I mean, it's all to this day, it's one of those moments that brings the hairs up on the back of your neck.
"Lights, please." "And there were in the same country shepherds, abiding in the field, keeping watch over their flock by night. And lo, the angel of the Lord came upon them. And the glory of the Lord shone round about them. And they were sore afraid. And the angel said unto them, Fear not."
In fact, it was very soon, it was the next day. People were clamoring with praise for Schultz and saying, "Thanks for putting Christ back in Christmas."
That's what Christmas is all about, Charlie Brown.
But Schultz himself, I think, really believed up to a point, and then you start hearing him in the 70s declaring himself a secular humanist. The strip, I think, really backs up the picture of Charles Schultz as a boy, as an artist, evolving through his life. On his honeymoon, he, by the account of his bride and later ex-wife Joyce Halverson, he turned to her on their honeymoon as they drove west to Colorado Springs and said, "You know, I don't think I'll ever be happy." What a thing to hear on your honeymoon. I think he saw unhappiness as a way of life in some ways, yearning, longing, never fulfilling.
But punctuated by moments of kind of romantic ecstasy and swooning.
Yes, but where I saw Schultz so clearly in the strip was in Snoopy sitting on the doghouse roof with the typewriter and typing out the famous sentence, the Bulwer Lytton.
"It was a dark and stormy night."
Yes. And there you see Linus coming by and saying, "Oh, that's a nice sentence. Good luck on your second sentence." And then you become aware that Snoopy's actually stuck at the first sentence. Well, as the first tortured paragraph emerges of this novel that Snoopy is presumably writing, we see that actually he really wants to just go back to the beginning, and where his happiness is writing out the portent and drama of
it was a dark and stormy night. And I think Schultz, in so much of his life, he loved to be at the beginning. He loved the first flush of romance. He loved the idea of love. He wanted to be at the beginning. And in fact, cartoonists are rendered beginners every morning. Peanuts was one of the cartoons that was always unresolved and which has no real ending and can therefore go on and on forever.
David Michaelis, thank you very much.
Thank you, Kurt.
David Michaelis' book is called Schultz and Peanuts, a biography. I spoke to him in 2008. Peanuts was popular all over the world, including Panama. That's where Geraldine Dupuy discovered it.
Well, I was born in Panama, Panama City. I'm an only child, and my mother was a fanatic, and so she would litter my room with all of the memorabilia.
Here I am. I'm Victoria Dupuy. I'm Geraldine's mother. We have been fans of Snoopy for a very long time. When I was, I think, 14, going to 15, the new girl came to our class. This girl called Alice, she came from a home in the Canal Zone. That was a territory that belonged to the Americans. And she was the cutest person because she didn't have many words. But when she smiled or she laughed, it was like the sun coming out. One day she gave me one Snoopy book, one Charlie Brown Snoopy book. Just like that, she gave it to me, and I was so, how do you say, I enjoyed so much. It made me really, really laugh loud. I was hooked. So when Geraldine was born, of course, you know, I would buy everything for her, all the pajamas, all the t-shirts, the lunchbox. She was bombarded with the old Snoopy things because I was such a fanatic and I wanted her to appreciate it. And then I think her first words was Snoopy.
I think she's like embellishing a little bit. I'm quite sure that she told me that my first word was agua, which is water in Spanish, but I'll accept that. I definitely sort of recall like going through my mother's old copies, the really battered, dog-eared copies that she had.
And through Snoopy, we learn lots more about American life. You know, the holidays, the Halloween, and the Great Pumpkin, and Thanksgiving, and of course, Christmas.
The idea of having a fall where the leaves fell at such a capacity that you had to rake them, and the idea of there being a winter where there was snow is just inconceivable because Panama, being so close to the equator, is just constantly on the same sort of level.
You know, the snow when they had, and the skating, you know, when they were in ice skating.
Oh, ice skating on a lake. We moved from Panama City to London and the UK because my father was transferred there. Like, he's a lawyer, so he was sent over there to open an office.
Then I said, my God, I have the opportunity to go to London and then to learn English. And also I thought of Geraldine, that, you know, what an opportunity for her.
Hey, Chuck, how about this? We're in England. Did you ever think you'd be in England, Chuck?
But to be sort of suddenly thrust into school in a new language... It was just, I do remember being kind of generally isolated the first few years we were there, and also the presence of Snoopy sort of being a constant and always just sort of being in the background.
And also the English are, you know, they are very good people, but they are very distant, you know, a bit on the cold side. And sometimes we couldn't find Snoopy books, the new ones, in the UK.
We would basically have to resort to the layover in Miami when we would fly back to Panama.
We had to go to the bookshop to get books for her to read in the plane. Because if she didn't have a book, she would be miserable.
We would stop after going through transit, go to the mall, get in a cab, and like tear through Walden Books and sort of buy up every Snoopy anthology that we could possibly find.
I mean, it was a very happy moment. Running, you know, in between flights.
We would just make a beeline to Waldenbooks. That was my priority. And then the food court, where we would have a corn dog. Well, that's what I would have.
I'm telling you that even now that, you know, the other day, I took a Snoopy book and, you know, I opened it. And then the first thing, you know, the second page, I was laughing already.
And Woodstock, you know, Woodstock's just hilarious. He's like the straight man. I can definitely see how Snoopy and Woodstock would be a stand-in for my mother and myself.
Because they were very happy together. They shared everything. And Snoopy was like the guide for Woodstock.
Of course she would take Snoopy for herself. Yes. No, definitely. When you move somewhere with somebody and there's nobody else around, you know, if my dad's working, it's just my mother and I, when I was little, in a country where she was learning the language, the relationship transcends that of mother and daughter. It really becomes one of companion. And I think in many ways, Snoopy and Woodstock are sort of those companions to each other.
When she left home to go to university, I always tell my friends that it was like she flew away.
This probably epitomizes my relationship with my mother. Snoopy receives another letter from Woodstock, and he says, "Ah, another letter from Woodstock, who's at Eagle Camp. Dear friend of friends, today we heard a special lecture by a caterpillar who had crawled all the way across a freeway without getting run over. It was a very exciting adventure. He had all of us sitting on the edge of our branches. Ha ha." And Snoopy looks up, he's like, "That Woodstock." He's just hit the face, he's cracking a little smile, and I can just imagine my mother receiving a letter like this, or an email like this from me at college. And just being like, "Oh, that Jerry."
Exactly. She is Woodstock. Yeah.
Thanks to Derek John for bringing us that story. Is there some cartoon or symphony or movie or any other cultural work that changed your life? Tell us about it at studio360.org and we might put your story on the air. Coming up, a tale of signals crossed and a phone call you weren't supposed to hear.
All client wishes it to look like simple robbery.
No, don't worry. Everything is going to be okay.
All right, then. Be sure to...
How unspeakably awful.
Sorry, Wrong Number, a drama that shocked Americans in 1943 and became one of the signature creations of the golden age of radio. That's ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. Every year, the Library of Congress chooses 25 recordings to honor and preserve. Sometimes they're seminal record albums, like Loretta Lynn's. Or comedy, like Mel Brooks and Carl Reiner's 2,000-Year-Old Man.
Could you give us the secret of your longevity?
Well, the major thing is that I never, ever touch fried food.
One of the National Recording Registry picks this year is a radio play from 1943. It's called Sorry, Wrong Number. It became a movie a few years later, starring Barbara Stanwyck and Burt Lancaster. The radio play, starring Agnes Moorehead, was written by Lucille Fletcher. It really terrified audiences at the time and became a milestone in radio history. Fletcher died at age 88 in 2000, so to tell the story of the recording of that play, we've got an especially devoted listener.
My name is Dorothy Herman. I'm Lucille Fletcher's older daughter.
And a scholar.
My name is Steve Darnall. I'm a radio historian and the host of two weekly radio shows devoted to that period known as the Golden Age of Radio.
Radio was very important to me. I used to listen to it all the time. And so as a child, I listened to The Shadow.
Who knows what evil lurks in the hearts of men?
I listened to Inner Sanctum, which just it shivers up and down my spine.
Good evening, friends of the Inner Sanctum. This is your host to welcome you in through the squeaking door to another half hour of horror.
Suspense.
Suspense was an anthology show that ran on CBS Radio from 1942 until the very end of the golden age of radio in the fall of 1962. I think the narrator of Suspense very early on in the show's run said it was about presenting a precarious situation and then withholding the solution until the last possible moment.
And so it is with Sorry, Wrong Number and the performance of Agnes Moorehead. We again hope to keep you in suspense.
And so the story begins with the main character, Mrs. Elbert Stevenson, trying to reach her husband on the telephone. She's an invalid, so she can't leave her bedroom.
Your call, please.
Operator, I've been dialing Murray Hill 70093 now for the last three quarters of an hour, and the line is always busy. I don't see how it could be busy that long. Will you try it for me, please?
I will be glad to try that number for you. One moment, please.
And she overhears two gentlemen plotting this murder on the telephone.
Our client wishes it to look like simple robbery.
Now don't worry. Everything is going to be okay.
All right, then. Be sure to...
Oh, how awful. How unspeakably awful.
And the entire show is based around the hysteria of the main character.
These two men, they were cold-blooded fiends, and they were going to murder somebody, some poor innocent woman who was all alone in a house near a bridge, and we've got to stop them. We've got to...
What number were you calling, please?
Well, that doesn't matter. This was a wrong number, and you dialed it for me, and we've got to find out what it was immediately.
What number did you call?
Oh, why are you so stupid?
Lucille Fletcher, who wrote the script, wrote Mrs. Stevenson as, frankly, not a terribly likable woman.
My mother came from a working-class family in Brooklyn, and she won a scholarship to Vassar College. And as a poor scholarship student, she felt that these very rich girls who came to school in their limousines, she felt that they snubbed her. And to make matters worse, she had a boyfriend who was an upper-class young man who was studying at Dartmouth, and he had a mother who was very much like Mrs. Stevenson, and she looked down on my mother, and this made my mother very miserable. So I think that she was taking a revenge on a lot of people in her radio play.
Now, I want to trace that call. It's my civic duty, it's your civic duty to trace that call and apprehend those dangerous killers, and if you won't...
I will connect you with the chief operator.
Please!
There is what would appear to be a fairly mundane sound effect, which is the picking up and dialing of a telephone. The sound people, they had to perform their tasks by listening to Agnes Moorehead.
Oh, dear.
And as she got increasingly agitated and panicked, they had to change the manner in which they picked up and dialed the telephone. Mrs. Stevenson becomes aware that the murder she overheard being plotted is her own murder. And so by the end of the story, when she's in an absolute state of terror, you can hear that in the way the phone is being dialed. When she's attacked in her bedroom, Agnes Moorehead screams. And she worked it out so that her scream would be the exact pitch of the whistle of the train that was going by her home. I think it was one of the first times that someone had had the audacity to go on radio, this national network, and present a story in which the killers get away.
I think my mother took delight and the end of Mrs. Stevenson, that she's trapped by her own invalidism and her own neuroticism, and also the fact that nobody will believe her.
It was a brutal message to send to radio audiences in 1943, which is sometimes people simply get murdered, and the police cannot stop it.
Police Department, Martin speaking. Police Department, Martin speaking.
Oh, Police Department?
Police Department.
I'm sorry, must have got the wrong number. Don't worry, everything's okay.
Our story was produced by Devin Strolovich for BNP Audio. The novelist Carl Hiaasen has been writing crime stories for decades, some of them true. Early in his career, he served on the Miami Herald's investigations team, reporting on medical malpractice and drug smuggling. Then he started writing novels about freaks doing criminally freaky things, all set in Florida. You think Florida's a zany, grotesque place with more grifters and nutballs and sleazy developers and corrupt politicians than anywhere else in America? Well, that's pretty much Carl Hiaasen's doing.
On the hottest day of July, trolling in dead calm waters near Key West, a tourist named James Mabry reeled up a human arm. His wife flew to the bow of the boat and tossed her breakfast burritos.
That's the opening scene of his novel Bad Monkey, which came out a few years ago.
What are you waiting for? James Mabry barked at the mate. Get that thing off my line. The kid tugged and twisted, but the barb of the hook was embedded in bone. Finally, the captain came down from the bridge and used bent-nose pliers to free the decomposing limb, which he placed on shaved ice in a deck box. James Mabry said, "For Christ's sake, now where are we supposed to put our fish?" "We'll figure that out when you actually catch one."
The story shifts to a disgraced police detective named Andrew Yancey, who learns about the severed limb and becomes determined to figure out where it came from.
Well, Yancey is a cop, sort of imagines himself a hotshot detective in the Keys, Monroe County, and he gets in some trouble, romantic trouble, ends up losing his badge, and they demote him. But he's trying to get back on the regular police force by solving this arm is floated, and it was caught by a tourist on a fishing boat. And everyone thinks it's obviously a victim of a boating accident, somebody that got hit in the propeller or whatever. And he's suspicious, and so he sets off. And the arm ends up in his freezer, in his personal in the freezer with the popsicles for a great length of time. And he feels now an obligation to it.
The book's bad guy is this fraudulent Medicare profiteer, and you call in the book South Florida America's Medicare fraud capital.
Yeah, it is.
Which you've also written about in columns.
Yes.
Medicare fraud. Do you, at this point, think of your day job as a kind of R&D's end of your fiction writing?
That's absolutely true, Kurt. I mean, I probably couldn't write the novels I write if I didn't at least have one toe in the newsroom, and in the sense, not that I'm physically there, but I'm writing and I'm engaged and I'm reading all the different newspapers in Florida. And so this constant over-the-transom flow of sleaze inspires the novel. It can't help to. It also keeps you angry enough because you know that. I mean, a lot of the funniest writers I know, funniest people I know, have a deep vein of anger, and it's a sense of sort of ironic outrage at things. And they're not happy-go-lucky people. I mean, they're writing for a reason. If you go back, Mark Twain was not a sunny personality most of the time. So this is how you get it out.
And for a guy who writes very angrily a lot, you don't seem angry at all. Maybe you get it out in your writing.
I get it. I mean, it's pure. I tell people it's psychotherapy for me. I'd do it if I didn't have to do it, I think. And I have been since. I mean, the feeling started when I was very young. I mean, I was 5 or 6 when they started paving my childhood, right? You know, the boom years of Florida back in the late 50s, early 60s, all throughout, just watching it disappear. Even as a kid, you have a sense of outrage. I don't know, you didn't know politically how did this happen? How did they do it? But it still pissed you off.
Yep.
And so I vented from an early age, and I got lucky and later went to work for the newspaper and got a newspaper column eventually, and I got to vent there a lot. But the books are good too because I get to write my own endings on the books.
you called South Florida in one of your recent columns the poster child for national dysfunction. Why is that? Why so much weirdness and rot in this one place? And at this point, as I said at the outset, thanks partly to you, all of America regards Florida as this special, unfortunate case.
It's always been a land where dreamers have come. And when you have people with a dream and with an image and sort of an iconic sense of we're going to move down there and everything's going to be fine, you also have a predatory element that moves with it. I've always told people, I said, if you are a car thief, for example, if you steal cars for a living, would you rather steal cars in Detroit, Michigan in January or on Miami Beach in January? Where would you rather be?
Yeah.
So it makes sense.
Now, other than the fact that you like to play golf or at least you've written about playing golf and you like to fish,
yeah.
Does it ever strike you as odd that you choose to live in this place that you have made a career sort of savaging and satirizing?
Yeah, I've been trying to scare people away from Florida for literally 35 years, and I still get letters from readers saying, we love your books, but please don't be mad. We're moving to Florida anyway. Where else? I really have roots. I love the place enough to stay and fight. It's easy to bail out and move to, Santa Fe or something and put on some clogs and walk around and look at the art galleries or whatever. But I can't do that. You can't disengage. It's the same way so many writers are connected to New York.
Right. Even despite its expense, its difficulty,
and
all that.
Frustrations and all the headaches. They could never pull themselves away to be creative somewhere else.
Yeah.
And that's sort of the way I feel.
The Demi Moore movie, Striptease, was an adaptation of your novel.
Mm.
As a chronicler of eccentrics and sleaze, how did Hollywood stack up against South Florida?
They were very nice to me. Everybody was. Demi was everything. I went in with very modest expectations, if I can put it like that. When you have a nightclub in the book called The Eager Beaver, this is not Citizen Kane material. I never went in with that thinking that.
Citizen Kane wasn't Citizen Kane material.
Right. But I always tell people, say, oh, but I didn't look what they did to your book. And I said, they didn't do anything to my book.
Right.
They made a movie.
Exactly.
You can pick the book out of the shelf in the library and it's the same book. You can't take it too seriously. I know writers that have been completely poleaxed by the whole Hollywood experience, and they take it so intensely and personally.
But just go in with zero expectations.
No, and also the whole process is satirical in many ways. Meetings and the notes you get if you can't laugh, you'll go out of your mind.
I was happy to see on your bio on your website that you say of that film, Burt Reynolds slathered from neck to toes with Vaseline is one of the golden moments in modern American cinema. Your fellow Floridian.
Yeah,
Burt.
He was a trip on the set, I'll tell you, and he was very nice to me. But that one scene, which was right out of the book, and I had modeled his character after my own congressman who had gotten busted in a strip joint. I just poached it from the headlines, and the guy passed away right before the movie came out, and I always felt bad because he would have been so flattered. He looked nothing like Burt Reynolds, I can assure you. I think Herb Burke was his name. I think he would have been very thrilled to have been portrayed, even the way Burt did it.
You published quite a few novels before your big commercial breakthrough, Striptease. That is a lot of writing and publishing to do before the world says, my God, you're this great best-selling novelist. Did you ever get close to saying, maybe this isn't working out?
Never. Because you know what? I always, you know what it's like when the box of books comes. You busted your ass writing this thing. And then months go by. It's like this gestation. And then the books come. And it's still a big high to do it.
Yeah.
And I never felt like giving up because the other thing is I had to do it. I was working in the newsroom all day then, and then on the investigations team where we didn't write that much.
Right.
You might write once every 3 or 4 months on a project. So you get all this writing energy built up, and the books were what got me through that. So I wouldn't have stopped no matter how many rejection letters.
You felt fortunate to be published?
I still do.
Yeah.
Still do.
Carl Hiaasen, this has been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It's great fun.
Carl Hiaasen's latest novel is called Skink, No Surrender, and it's out next week. Carl and I also had a great conversation about Disney World, about his loathing as a native Floridian of Disney World and all that it stands for, and his feud with them. You can hear all about that at studio360.org. And that is it for this week's show. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week after we all recover from our tryptophan hangovers. In the meantime, we'd love to hear from you and give thanks if you were to write a review of the show on iTunes. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. The team here includes
Jenny Lawton,
Andrew Adam Newman,
Louis Mitchell,
Matt Frasica,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Lynn Levy,
Krista Ripple,
Emil Klein,
Elizabeth Kulas,
Caroline Lester,
Tommy Bazarian.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiekum.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, the new movie In the Heart of the Sea tells the story of the real-life whale that inspired Moby Dick.
I kept saying, he's not Jaws, he's King Kong. They mess with the wrong
right,
dude.
Right, exactly.
Director Ron Howard next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.